Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Winning the battle but losing the war. It's an old statement, but it applies to the American Indian, the Native Americans, the First Nation, after the Battle of Little Bighorn. Mr. Will Hutchison is our guest today, an extensive author of books on warfare and on American history, including the Crimean Memories, Artifacts of the Crimean War in 2009, and the novels Follow Me to Glory, Satan's Last Whisper, The Gettysburg Conspiracy, and now a major book, Artifacts of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, Custer, the 7th Cavalry, and the Lakota and Cheyenne Warriors. It's a remarkable book, large, wonderfully photographed. You'll enjoy having it, and I presume, Will, it's available on, will be, on Amazon.com.
Yes, it's available. It'll be available on all of the sites, and I'm fairly certain it is as of now.
So we're getting it hot off the press. We're sitting here looking at a copy, and the only one, so be careful while you're, don't look twice, it may be gone before you can get.
That's the only copy I have right this minute.
There are too many good things to ask about your work, but today let's just start with the idea of, let's start from the end first. What were the results of the Battle of Little Bighorn? This was the only major victory the American Indians had in the long war between the U.S. cavalry and other forces.
Well, perhaps not the only victory, but certainly the only major victory that was known throughout and history, and more books have been written on it than probably anything but Gettysburg.
Funny you should mention that one. And having won that battle didn't result in any, I'll have to use an evaluative statement, anything more positive for the American Indian?
Well, I think what happened, basically, they fought the battle in a way that was much more determined and much more aggressive on the part of the Indians than certainly Custer or any of the politicians in Washington or anyone else expected. And that particular day, the Indian warriors won the day. And the biggest reason, contrary to popular opinion, for Custer's failure that day was that the Indians were just better warriors. Mm-hmm. And they won the battle. It was a victory. It was a victory for them in the sense that it wasn't the first, by the way. The first victory was a week before that at the Battle of Rosebud that nobody ever hears about, where they actually beat General Crook and sent him back south. He was one of the three prongs that were supposed to trap the Indians in the middle. So they were on a high when the battle took place of Little Bighorn. They had just won a major battle down in this other area, and they were celebrating that when the Battle of Little Bighorn took place. And they also, I think, knew that this was their last chance to keep the Plains Indian way of life, which is very, very important to their culture. The buffalo were disappearing. Slowly but surely, the mainstay of the Indian, the buffalo, were disappearing. And they knew this, and they looked upon this battle as their last chance. And so they fought extremely well that day. They won the victory, and then they had to move their village very quickly because General Terry and General Gibbon were coming after Custer, and they were going. They had a much larger force, and they were not going to be able to fight that force. So the Indians moved their village rather quickly on the last day. In fact, one day before the General Terry and General Gibbon arrived on the scene. And then both the Cheyenne and the Lakota Indians, who were the bulk of the Indians who fought the battle, started moving away from the army. And the army began to chase them. And they were relentless. And eventually the Indians split into two different factions. Crazy Horse took one. And they decided that they would try to go back onto the reservation, which is where the army wanted them to be in the first place. Sitting Bull took the other group of Lakota Indians and moved north, and he was chased literally across the border into Canada. At that time, the Canadians were now faced with a problem of some 5,000 Lakota warriors going across into their country and had no idea what to do or what to expect.
And it's a lightly populated area to which they went, I imagine, Saskatchewan or Alberta?
It was not like
Alberta.
In our west, we were settled because we had the railroad going out there.
Already.
Our west had settlers and pioneers and was fairly well populated, and you're absolutely right. In Canada, they didn't have that kind of population. The only population they really had were more Indians, but of different tribes that didn't particularly like the idea of all these Lakota coming into these areas where they hunted buffalo and the buffalo being now limited. Mm-hmm. So it was a rather strained problem for the Canadians.
You've actually written, and I'm leading it to this, so this is we're not wandering off the subject. We're leading up to what how the Canadians handled the American Indians as compared to the United States. So since you have written on this subject in Satan's Last Whisper about the adventures in the Wild West of Canada in the 1870s, it occurs to me that we should really talk about the differences between how the Canadians, underpopulated and without a railroad, would handle their Native Americans, their First Nation, as compared to the U.S.
It's absolutely fascinating to me. I have a background in the military, 26 years in the military, so my background is partially military. My other background is 20 years in law enforcement. And so I can look at it from both a military standpoint and a law enforcement standpoint. And this became critical when I was doing the research, because the approach that we used in the United States was a military approach. The mantra was the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and so the army went out with the idea they were going to move them into small areas, confine them, and then, you know, they wouldn't be a problem anymore and the military would keep them down. When they moved into Canada, the only thing standing in front of them that was representing the Canadian government were 300 Northwest Mounted Policemen. And these were law enforcement types, Northwest Mounted Police.
The famous Mounties.
The famous Mounties of the North.
This is a challenge we didn't hear about when we were kids and they were out getting the one guy at a time, you know, the reprobate traitor or something.
Exactly. These were redcoats. They literally wore red coats. And so when the Indians came in, it wasn't Sitting Bull at first. It was a group of Lakota came in, and then other groups gradually came in, and finally Sitting Bull himself came into Canada, and they moved into an area near Wood Mountain, near the border, not that far from the border. And what the law enforcement folks, what the Northwest Mounted Police decided to do, was take a law enforcement approach instead of a military approach. And so when Sitting Bull came into Canada and set up his camp, the first thing he saw were three Northwest Mounted Policemen. Not 300 or 3,000, but three red coats.
What a sight. A test case in courage, right?
And the head of the three was a gentleman named James Walsh. James Walsh, if anything, was the Custer of the Northwest Mounted Police. Very flamboyant, very, very bigger-than-life kind of character. But also an officer in the Northwest Mounted Police, which meant he was also a magistrate and a policeman, both, because that's what their officers were. And so he went into Sitting Bull's camp, later became very good friends with Sitting Bull, and he introduced himself, and he said, "I want to talk to you and your chiefs in council." And Sitting Bull, of course, said, "That's fine, but it'll happen tomorrow." And not knowing what Walsh would do, Walsh said, "That's fine. I'll set my tent up right here next to yours in the middle of the Indian camp with three men."
That's a test of hospitality if there ever was one.
Of course, the Indians, one of their major tenets and values is hospitality, which is not well known when you look at the, quote, savage Indian. You don't think about the fact that generosity and hospitality were their primary values. In any event, the Indians thought that took a great deal of courage, never saw it before. And then what Walsh and his men did was they gave a talk to the chiefs, and they said, look, the great-grandmother Queen Victoria, will allow you to stay in Canada as long as you obey Canadian law. And the difference between America and Canada at that time was they were the law. And what they said was what went.
Mm-hmm.
And when they said to Sitting Bull, if you obey Canadian law, you will also come under Canadian law. If a white man does something to an Indian, he will be punished and prosecuted exactly the way an Indian mm-hmm. who does something mm-hmm. in the same manner to a white man. And we will prove it by doing it, by showing you that this will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Sitting Bull said, we'll see.
Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, Walsh is a magistrate, so he's not just there to round people up or to arrest people. He arrests them, but also...
And so they see swift justice.
It can go awry, of course, but out on the frontier, it turned out to be advantageous.
It could be absolutely bad because the danger of mm-hmm. having somebody with that much power. But in this particular instance, the way it worked was very, very complementary to the way that the Canadian government wanted it to work. And also, it was in favor of the Indians as well as the Northwest Mounted Police. They also went to the Indians that were in Canada, the Blackfoot, which was a huge tribe in Canada. They went to the Blackfoot and the other major Indian tribes of the First Nations of Canada, and they said the same thing to them. And they said, we will confine the Lakota to this one particular area, and everyone will agree you will obey the law, and as long as you obey the law, you can stay in Canada. If you don't, then you have to go back to America. And what they told them was, the other caveat was, you can't raid across the border.
Oh, yes. We don't want any international incidents here, please. This is not the border with Mexico and Pancho Villa.
That's exactly right. Now, in the long run, after years of staying in Canada, eventually the Lakota all came back to the United States, or a large number of them, including Sitting Bull, in the end. And they did go back onto a reservation. And this was because... the two governments, Canada and the United States, had been negotiating for this to happen, and they still wanted the Indians to come in on the reservation, because what was happening sub rosa was that some of the Indians were raiding across the border, and the United States couldn't cover the entire border, so they still wanted to confine them. So in the long run, even that didn't work out very well for the Indians. And this was the beginning of the end. Little Bighorn was the winning of a battle, but the mm-hmm. losing of a war, the mm-hmm. beginning of the mm-hmm. end of losing the war.
Yeah. We're talking to Will Hutchison, who currently is the author. I say currently because he's a widely published author and photographer. He's currently published Artifacts of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. In fact, it is so current that we have the only copy in front of us right now, and it is handsome. It's 8.5 by 11. It is glossy, beautifully photographed. We can talk about how he did that as well. But it's well worth picking up if you are interested in the life of the American Indian, of the U.S. Cavalry, and especially of the Battle of Little Bighorn. It has almost all of the artifacts, including some of Custer's private belongings, which showed up in later battles. Couldn't be recovered immediately because Custer didn't make it through the battle. I'm Jerry Christensen, and you're listening to the Seminary Explorers. Let's, for the sake of the people who are saying it during this conversation, okay, enough of the big story. We want to hear about Little Bighorn. Tell me about some of the myths that you've discovered, either about the battle itself or about Custer, and what current scholarship is saying in response to those myths.
There are so many myths and so much propaganda that's been put out about this battle that it's almost hard to know where to begin. I doubt that there's a blade of grass on Little Bighorn battlefield that is not in controversy by somebody somewhere. And it has been my privilege to belong to several organizations that focus on the Battle of Little Bighorn, and some of these historians, they're absolutely amazing. They're the people that I go to and ask the questions of, and love to sit and talk for hours about this particular battle. And the myths all began because nobody survived. If one person had survived of the command directly under Custer, none of this probably would have been as large as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that nobody survived in his entire command, which was basically one more than one third of the entire 7th Cavalry that was there. That's one of the big myths, as a matter of fact, that no one survived. Well, the fact is, the 210 men that were with Custer didn't survive. And that was basically two battalions. There were two other battalions that did survive, but they were surrounded by the Indians, and they were surrounded at the time that Gibbon and Terry finally arrived on the battlefield. The Indians were leaving just as they were arriving, and the men that were in this surrounded area were cheering as the soldiers came, because they actually rescued them. Mm-hmm. That's one of the big myths. The other, I went out there originally when I started this project. I was not a big fan of General Custer. I knew him from Hunterstown, as we do here
in Gettysburg. Hunterstown, Pennsylvania, outside of Gettysburg.
Outside the Battle of...
He had his first test right in your backyard, more or less, didn't he?
And it wasn't that good a test. he led 80 men into an ambush. Yeah. He was dehorsed, and the only reason he got out alive without being captured was because he was put on the back of one of the privates who had gone with him, put him on the back of his horse, and took him out of the combat to save him. And so that was my idea. This is Custer. And I was, with a military background, I was not enamored with him as an officer. Since I have done this research, I've changed my mind completely. I've changed my view. I honestly believe now that George Armstrong Custer did exactly at Little Bighorn what Merritt or Kilpatrick or any of the other cavalry commanders of that time would have done in the same situation, with the same intelligence, knowing the past of what the Indians had done. One of the things for me was to put myself into that period so that I could see, in my mind, what Custer, as a military man, had in front of him at the time and what he did to compensate or to strategize to do what he did. And frankly, it's kind of hard to find many faults. There are a lot of... He made mistakes, but there were the myths far outweigh the mistakes he made. They say he didn't know how many Indians there were. He knew almost exactly how many Indians there were. They had a meeting on the far west before he left, and he was told that the Indians are going to be about 1,200 to anywhere 1,500 or more warriors, and that's exactly what there were. The difference wasn't numbers, it was attitude. The Indians fought extremely well, and they weren't expected to fight. They were expected to do what they had always done in the past, which is protect their women and children, stay there just long enough to do that, and then disappear, and then the army would run after them. That was the historic way that they would protect the village.
How did Custer get separated from the other two battalions, which would have made it a little bit more equal? He only had 210 men to face 1,500 Americans.
There is a very basic tactic, both infantry and cavalry, where you place a base of fire in front of the enemy.
Oh yeah.
You take them, they all come at the base of fire. Okay. That takes care of that group. And then you circle around to the side, you flank them on the side, then you hit them from the flank or the rear. That was the maneuver he was doing. He took one battalion, put them in as your base of fire. He took the other two battalions, there was a third battalion, but he took the other two battalions that were with him and brought them around in a flanking movement. And he expected that the battalion behind him that was still coming up and the train with the ammunition, which had another 120 men on it, would be reinforcing him. So he would have a lot of men to hit that flanking movement. That's one of the problems of the battle, is that they never materialized. But that was the basic maneuver.
In our last minutes together, let's talk about how you did this book. Now that I've seen it, it really is a remarkable piece of research and publication. How did you get these wonderful photographs of artifacts, including maps? And
I have his map. The one map he had with him, which was taken off of an Indian after the battle and given to General Miles, who then gave it to Elizabeth Custer, who gave it to the West Point Museum, which is where I took a photograph of it. The artifacts themselves are hard to find. I didn't realize how hard when I started the project, because they hadn't been that hard to find for the Crimean War, because every town that had a regiment that was in the Crimean War had a museum. And so every museum had a section on the Crimean War. Not so with this battle. They were much, much harder to find, particularly Indian artifacts. I still don't have as many as I would have liked to have had, because I wanted it to be more even, and I just couldn't come up with those artifacts. There were a lot of one-offs where I had to travel long distances to get one artifact photograph, and it was very cost ineffective. So I ended up in this book, it's probably 60% my photography and 40% what I managed to get from other people.
You had the privilege of being in at the museum with a special permission at Little Bighorn?
Yes, and I'm very thankful to the National Park Service folks who helped me with that. Ordinarily, folks are not allowed to photograph the artifacts. It's just they can't get them out. They can't put their hands on them. If you photograph them, you have to do it through glass. It becomes very problematic. I knew this, and so I went out and asked permission to actually photograph them. I showed them what I had done in my other book on the Crimean War, and the folks that were out there, I thought they were going to say no. And then a voice behind me, who happened to be the boss, said, "How would you feel about coming out of here under contract with the government and photographing our entire collection?"
Yeah, that is different.
And I, of course, said, "Yes."
Well, maybe.
and that's what I did. And what they did for me was they closed the museum down. They put a room in the back. I drove out in my truck from the East Coast, from Gettysburg. I brought my lights, my cameras. I brought an entire studio, and I set it up there. And then the folks from the National Park Service, I in white gloves, they in white gloves, would bring the artifacts into my set one at a time, and we'd photograph those artifacts. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing journey. It was just unbelievable to actually see these artifacts and not see them behind glass, but to actually be able to, you know, I had to touch them because I had to move them inside the set, but I always had the white gloves on. And that's how most of the photographs in the book came about, was through that. And they have a huge Elizabeth Custer collection that is not on site. I mean, 140,000 items. But it's currently being stored in Tucson at a National Park Service facility, because the Park Service at the monument site is really small for storage. And they're going to bring it back when they build a new building to do that. But currently it's down there. And I knew that there were some artifacts I wanted. So part of what I had arranged with them was that they would also get me photographs taken in Tucson that I could use in the book. And I have the one-time publishing rights for these. And if the folks who are listening want a photograph, when they go to the monument and ask for a photograph, they'll be getting one of my photographs.
The result of all this is Artifacts of the Battle of Little Bighorn by Will Hutchison, who is our guest today. I'm Jerry Christensen. For the Seminary Explorers, have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers from Historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.